Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you. So tonight, talk about the federal judiciary, particularly the United States Supreme Court. Is it a bulwark for liberty, guardian of the Constitution, rule of law, or just a tool of the oligarchs? Well, we'll talk about that tonight. Well, according to the American constitutional system, this is what we learn in civics class, is we have a system of checks and balances, separation of powers. And there are three branches in the U.S. government. This is the federal government, of course. That's established by the Constitution. There's a legislative branch, which makes the law, supposedly. They write the laws. And it's the executive branch, which enforces the law, executes the law. And then there's a judicial branch, which is charged with interpreting the law. And the idea is each branch kind of checks the other. Well, that's the theory. Now, the Supreme Court generally is understood as a sort of a last stop to whenever there's a law being challenged or policy being challenged by the U.S. government to see whether it passes constitutional muster, and they'll declare something constitutional, something unconstitutional, supposedly on their wisdom and their understanding or their in-depth knowledge of the law and the Constitution. And they're there to sort of check the ambitions of the other two branches of government. They're independent. They're appointed for life, except for good behavior. Theoretically, they can be impeached, but that's never happened. I think there was a trial during the Jefferson presidency, Salmon Chase. And ever since then, I don't think there's been a Supreme Court justice that has been impeached. That doesn't say there hasn't been one that has deserved to have been impeached. So, the federal judiciary, what's your take on the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, I think it's an example of regulatory capture, which is a term that has, you know, come into vogue recently concerning particularly drug companies controlling the regulating bodies that are supposed to determine, you know, the safety of their product. With the Supreme Court, you can see if you just go through kind of the statistics of the individual justices, the fact that the secret societies have always controlled the Supreme Court. So basically, you know, it is a regulatory body. It's supposed to be part, as you said, of the checks and balances. But, you know, if you look at the chief justices from 1789 through 1795, you know, Jay and Rutledge, they're Freemasons, and, you know, secret societies, particularly the Masons, have these oaths which are sacrosanct. They're more powerful than any other oath that an individual may take. This has been well established by members who have, you know, left the organization. So you can't really be something else. You can't represent yourself as an honest arbitrator of U.S. law and also be a Mason. It's just not possible. And then when you go through the control that the Masons have had over the Supreme Court, particularly for the first, 150 years, you see all these chief justices, Oliver Ellsworth and John Marshall. And then you get other individuals, you know, who are influencing the Supreme Court that are in other kinds of secret societies. For example, you know, William H. Taft. Now he's one of the founders of Skull and Bones. You have, you know, recently you have Earl Warren, who was a chief justice, who was, you know, big time Mason. So, you know, we talked a lot about how we just see kind of the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the secret societies in terms of the control over our regulatory bodies. You know, you have occasionally the congressmen are identified, obviously the presidents you can come, you know, see. In the Supreme Court, I just wanted to give an example of how, you know, people may not be known as Masons, but if you dig into them a little bit, you can see that there's just something wrong with their background. They have some connections into secret societies that are completely unusual. And the one I was going to give was Anthony Scalia. He was purportedly, you know, a Catholic, though as a Catholic, he had a strange connection into Jews and Judaism. He studied the Talmud, which, you know, was not something that was normal for a Catholic, though, of course, he was a man of intellectual breadth, so, you know, perhaps it doesn't have any meaning. But when he was killed, I guess he, or died, you know, the details are contested. You know, you can go on the internet, you can see. But one thing that is not contested is that the people that Scalia was with were members of this thing called the International Order of St. Hubertus. Now, that's a secret society. It has to do with hunting, but no one's ever heard of it. I mean, until Scalia died with in a ranch was owned by a guy, and he had been brought there by someone who was in this international order. No one had ever heard about this thing. I mean, the public had no idea. But if you look into this thing, you realize that it was actually brought to the U.S. and launched by Bohemian Grove in San Francisco. So this is sort of a red flag. But then you go deeper, you go, well, who created it? And then you can find that it was the infamous Franz Anton von Spork, the famous Freemason from Prague, who is one of the most satanic and evil individuals in history. And so, you know, given that the secret societies are obviously in back of so much of our political life, you know, we discussed, you know, the fact that Francis Scott Keyes had created the Star Spangled Banner. He's not really known as a Mason. But then if you analyze the third stanza, you can see that, wait a second, you know, it clearly is. This guy is a Mason. So they had the secret societies, you know, kind of involved in the symbolism of our nation in ways that are not overt. When you look at the Supreme Court, you see all of these people who are Masons, right, just out and out known. But then you have people like Scalia, and you wonder, well, what really is in back of these guys? And I think that when you look at the behavior of the court and how it really hasn't done anything to protect what I would think are the real rights of the Constitution that you know, citizens should be expecting, that this is explained by the fact that it's controlled, that this, like the regulatory bodies over, you know, modern pharmaceutical companies are basically manned by individuals who will soon be on the payroll or have been on the payroll of the companies that they're supposed to regulate. I think the Supreme Court is just another captured regulatory entity. And, you know, the thing that the citizens should do about it is basically try to crack the identity of the secret society. I know we're going to talk about some of the decisions. Really important, you know, to go through some of the decisions because they seem insane and they seem counterintuitive. But my opinion is that they're not. That in fact, like giving corporations the basically the status of a human being in terms of being able to fund political campaigns, that's to be expected. That's really a reflection of the control that the secret society has over this entity. And so what decisions do you think we should discuss tonight, Tim?
Well, I think your point regarding the Supreme Court, how it's the court collectively, either from the left or from the right, or he seems to provide the most broad interpretation of governmental power, particularly in regards to the federal government, and very narrowly interpret the rights of the people.
And that's Isn't that something?
Yeah, they've always done that. And a good example is Scalia, who would render some good decisions on maybe perhaps some issues like the gay marriage dispute or something, or perhaps on abortion. But then when it came to issues like surveillance, he'd come down on the side of the police state. On Fourth Amendment issues, he was very poor on. And it was always interesting. Someone always says he was a great legal mind, and some of his greatest opinions were in his book, Scalia Dissents. So he's always rendered the great decisions when he was on the losing end. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And
that's when his best thinking.
Yeah, best thinking. So the you can always rely on the Supreme Court to furnish enough votes, 5 votes, to advance an agenda if need be. And come up with some, you know, they'll put together some sort of sophomoric argument to justify yet another abuse or usurpation on behalf of the federal government to advance, you know, the agenda. And I do think it's important to point out this sort of secret society connection, because ultimately that's what the oligarchs are operating under sort of the secret society to network and get business done. I read somewhere that all justices are millionaires, which, you know, civil servants, I don't see how making $150,000 a year or whatever the judges make. Obviously, the strange circumstances surrounding Scalia's death were interesting, to say the least. No real autopsy. The family supposedly didn't want it, and I guess whether that's true or not, you know. But my point is, whenever you have a high-ranking government official just suddenly die, no matter how old he, I think he was 78, 77, 78, yeah. It's that public official belongs to the people. And there should have been, I mean, I'm sure if the deep state wanted to kill Scalia for some reason, or secret society wanted to do it, they could engineer an autopsy. But the fact is, they didn't have to. They had this judge show up, and description was read over the phone, and then there was no cause of death. It was just written off as heart failure or something. There was never an examination. But obviously, a Supreme Court justice dying can have a profound impact on governmental policy, the course of the court. You can neutralize or stop the court, you know, if you make it 4-4 for a while. And so there wasn't any real investigation, and any expression of suspicion would label a conspiracy theorist, despite the fact that, you know, obviously there's something, you know, there's a lot at stake when you have a high government official dying. And so, and, you know, they get a lot of privileges and perks for being a Supreme Court justice. They get a park. They have a parking place at the airport, and they probably don't get traffic tickets too often. So
no.
they kind of belong to the people. That's the part of the job when they get these positions of trust. So that, yeah, well, it was strange. And of course, that weird society out there, hunting club.
I mean, one that's just a cutout for Freemasonry. Mm. You see, this is the thing, is that you can't, you know, because Scalia was supposedly a Catholic, just like Roberts, I think, is supposed to be Catholic. But I think these guys are cryptos. Now, I don't know what, but I really don't think that they're Catholics per se. I just think this is, you know, it's sort of like the Irish having political power, a kind of theocracy, but it doesn't ever do any good for the Irish people.
Yeah, it's right? Like, I think it's almost, from a standpoint of genuine Catholicism, can you wiggle yourself up the grease pole of political power in America without compromising yourself? I don't think it's possible.
No, it isn't. Yeah. And I don't think that you can make any movement up the pole of political politics if you aren't inside the club, you see.
Yeah.
And so it's not so much a question of compromise. I don't think Scalia was started out as a Catholic and wanted to, you know, had that as his background and just wanted to be a lawyer. I think that what was fake about him was his Catholicism. I think that if you look at how they control us, that the easiest push point they have is these ethnic and religious, you know, concepts. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like if you see a picture of Hillary and Donald Trump in their 20s, they have brown hair. Somehow, amazingly, they became blonde as they got older.
Yeah.
You know? And so you have these blondes, right? Supposedly, but you know, but the fact is that I have no evidence, you know, hard evidence, other than the fact that he was found, you know, in being basically taken around by members of this organization, but that's very, very troubling. And
yeah, I remember when it happened, everyone was kind of like, "Isn't this weird? I mean, why could he just die sitting in his study reading, like a lot of, you know, elder men? He dies at this weird, mysterious secret society." out west somewhere in the middle of the desert.
Think about it. I mean, if you're the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you are beyond a public representative. I mean, you could actually be argued that you're the most powerful individual in the American government.
Well, he was an associate justice, but nevertheless.
I know, but I mean, he was okay. So, but the thing is, he had a lot of sway.
Yeah.
And a lot of people thought that people that he would basically, you know, they thought that he was the one who was really the more powerful mind, and people followed him and things like this. Anyway, so Scalia should not be in attendance of clubs that are this devious and this secret.
And I think it was like a $9,000 night room or something.
Yeah. I mean, these things are just wrong. There's some kind of structural problem here, because you really want powerful people, people with, well, you know, to have some kind of openness so we know who they are.
And empathy for the people they rule over.
Well, empathy, and also just some kind of real disclosure, because, I mean, I don't remember Scalia coming forward during his nominating process and saying, you know, who I really am is a member of the International Order of St. Hubertus.
Yeah.
The Masonic cesspool organization set up by Baron von Aton, you know, the guy that's like Satanist guy from Prague in the Middle Ages. I mean, this is just preposterous.
No, it's just like in 2004, two members of Skull and Bones running for president, and only journalist that asked the question about it, and he dies of a heart attack furiously.
Yeah. So this is just kind of the same principle. Is that people use the expression deep state, but I don't like that expression because it doesn't really help clarify what we're dealing with.
Yeah.
It's not deep, and it's not a state. It's a secret society.
Yeah, when Scalia passed away a couple of years ago, I was talking to a lawyer, and we were just talking about judges, and D.C. lawyers, and they're in the Justice Department, they're in the system, and we were talking some of his jurisprudence. Some of the things I liked about his jurisprudence. His decisions, his political philosophy. Although I don't see how he reconciled the modern constitutional law with his idea of original intent. That's sort of the incoherence of the American system, because we have to deal with such anomalies like the so-called American Civil War, and there really isn't continuity in our system. That's the point. There really was a revolution, uprooted the old republic. But nevertheless, we were just talking about some of his rulings on Fourth Amendment issues and stuff that he had rendered. He always came outside sort of on the police state, surveillance state. And I think one of the rulings is, I forget the name of the King versus something. I think one of the things where the police had illegally entered homes, and when the man resisted, he was arrested, and the man sued because the police were illegally in the home, and the court ruled that the police can do this. And they're not liable. So, what about illegal? Don't they understand? And their idea was, on a no-knock raid, you don't have a right. You don't have a right to resist. You can be arrested for that without even a predicate offense. And the idea was, well, you can be arrested, and then the system will work, because then we'll find out you're innocent later on after you spend, I don't know, 2 months in jail and spend, $100,000 on legal fees. I suppose that's the system working, I suppose. And we were just talking how indifferent some of these judges can be to the plight of the average person who may fear the police or has no protection against the police, and nor can they really have the resources to provide adequate legal defense should they be confronted by the police or be arrested or something. And there's no empathy, there's no understanding for this.
You look at these decisions and you can just be certain that he's not a Catholic. That's how I look at this. I mean, a real Catholic would have a more structural empathy for poor people. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all, think about the Catholic vision of humanity, right? Okay. I mean, if he's supposed to be devout, this is one of the claims about him. Look, I grew up in the Catholic Church. I know thousands of, devout Catholic. No one is going to say, well, it's okay for the police to come in and just without a warrant and just arrest someone. They would always think that the individual, because of the concept of the soul and the concept of, Jesus' relationship with these individuals, they would have a bias for the individual. They would be looking at the Constitution through that lens. Scalia looked at it through the lens of the secret society. I mean, that's really the truth. And when you go through the decisions, it's the best way to analyze them is that, you know, the decisions show that they're not really in any way linked to organizations that are promoting the little person, that are trying to defend the citizens. They're completely in favor of the secret society and of dictatorial control, because the fact is that basically what's being set up is a technologic dictatorship. And that gives you a way to understand all of the judicial decisions.
Yeah.
If they are on this side of that issue, it doesn't matter how the issue is framed, if it's, you know, snooping in bathrooms or whatever they want to do, however they want to frame it, the lawsuits that are coming forward, they always end up with giving permission to the secret society to ratchet up the police state. See, this is the thing. And so that's why when Scalia died and he was, you know, with the bizarre Franz Anton von Spruch, the Austrian Freemasons organization, it didn't surprise me at all. It's just the other way. I think if you do research into these guys, it's amazing if you don't find this stuff, because it's hard to hide. It's circumstantial, but it's very hard to hide. And so it didn't surprise me that Scalia died under those circumstances. What's more surprising is that given the background of control by these organizations, I mean, think about just three organizations. Think about Bohemian Grove, the Masons, and Skull and Bones. All right. And think of the influence that those three organizations have upon the Supreme Court. If you add to that the power of Jewish justices, what's left for the common person, for the Gentile common person, Tim?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything left? You know, if you actually just go through these individuals, you see, you know, if you say, okay, well, you have, you know, a camp of, you know, Felix Frankfurter, you know, you get a couple who are the Jews on the courts now. And then you start looking at, Masons and people that are appointed by the Bush family, you know, who are skull and bones. There's nothing left for, you know, Gentile common person. Who do we have? You know, there's nobody on the court. So then you sit there and you wonder why is the Supreme Court, basically going along with the establishment of slave state? Well, it's because it is lock, stock, and barrel owned by the people who are setting up the slave state.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the, go back into the World War I, talking about some of these decisions and their opportunities for the court to stand up to an out-of-control government. And a good example would be the Woodrow Wilson administration and his engineering America's entry into the Second World War. And one example was, one of the ways he got the United States into the war was he was able to convince Congress that American participation would not require sending an expeditionary force to Europe. And so that's one of the reasons it facilitated a declaration of war. But then 2 months into the war, the summer of 1917, only 73,000 men had volunteered to go die in the trenches of France. And so they passed the Selective Service Act. I think that was in spring, but no one in the spring, a month after the declaration of war, but no one was signing up. So this created quite a stir, because this was the first time that they were drafting, the U.S. government presumed the right to draft people to go send off to fight some foreign war. And so there's litigation, and the Supreme Court pretty much said that despite the fact you had something called the 13th Amendment, which banned involuntary servitude and slavery, that this wasn't involuntary servitude because there was military service. So they're, you know, playing some semantic game to justify this. But the court, instead of declaring the Selective Service Act unconstitutional and then telling the federal government, you better go pass a constitutional amendment to get this passed. That's what you're going to need to do to get this passed. That would have frustrated the war effort, which was the interest of the oligarchs. So they just declared it constitutional, claiming that this was under the U.S. government's broad powers to Congress's broad powers to raise and support armies. I think the judgment was, or at least the justification was, it was under necessary and proper powers. But then again, is it proper to give the federal government general powers when theoretically all it has is enumerated and specific powers? And is it necessary? No, actually, it's improper and just convenient. That's true. It should be the improper and convenient clause. If the necessary and proper clause gives the government general grant of power, there's no point in painstakingly going through the effort and having enumerated and specific powers, right? It just contradicts the whole logic of the Constitution. Nevertheless, right. it was inconvenient. They needed to muster millions of men to go fight and die in France to achieve the war aim, which was the objective of the oligarchs, to kill as many people as possible and also bail out J.P. Morgan and the banks that had underwritten much of the war effort. So they declared it constitutional. Well, this was a chance. The Supreme Court was there to stand there and say, no, you cannot do this. This is unconstitutional. And it just bent over and, found justification. I mean, I think if you read the court decisions, it says it's very funny because the wording is very clever, but you can see right through it if you're looking at through the when you're trying to just reconcile it with the Constitution. And the court said, the highest duty of the citizen is to bear arms to call the nation. Okay, this is all very problematic from the standpoint of the United States history, because technically speaking, the United States was not a nation, actually. So this goes back to the Civil War thing. It was a confederation of independent states. Call of the nation. This duty is inherent in the citizenship. Without it, and the correlative power of the state to compel its performance, society could not be maintained. It is a contradiction in terms to say the United States is a sovereign and yet lacks the power of self-defense. Hence, the power was expressly granted to the Constitution and found in the power to declare war, which means a power to carry on war successfully. Also in the power to raise and support armies, which is conferred broadly. Actually, it wasn't. And without limitation, other than restrictions that appropriations to support armies shall not exceed 2 years. There is no provision limiting the means to voluntary enlistment. On the contrary, Congress is especially empowered to use all means necessary and proper to carry out and express the grant. So they, upon that, they declare the Selective Service Act constitutional. But if you know the history of conscription in the United States, is originally all the federal government was granted was a voluntary army and a voluntary navy. The primary defenses were provided by state militias, which did have the power to conscript, although most people just signed up voluntarily. But this is at the state level. And from the standpoint of wars, the president had the power to call up the militias if there was an invasion, an insurrection, or to enforce the laws of the nation. But the governors had the right to reject that claim if the conditions weren't met. And that happened in the War of 1812, actually. Two states refused to raise the militia to go fight the War of 1812. So this isn't something that's unlimited. It's rather controversial. And so the Supreme Court, that whole decision is based on sort of a mythology that had developed. One thing is the mythology of American nationhood, strictly speaking, and the fact that the government had unlimited power to raise and support armies, and actually had only specific powers to raise armies. But this is, again, this is sort of this gradualism, concentration, the concentration of political power in the United States. But the draft itself is very controversial, and I think there's a quote here. During the War of 1812, the first time the federal government attempted to impose a military draft, actually there's a conscription bill passed in Congress, which faced fierce opposition and didn't pass. And, of course, one of the speakers against it was Daniel Webster of Massachusetts, who said this on the floor of the House of Representatives. The administration asserts the right to fill the ranks of the regular army by compulsion. Is this, sir, consistent with the character? Is this consistent with the character of a free government? Is this civil society? Is this the real character of our Constitution? No, sir, indeed it is not. Where is it written in the Constitution? What article or section is it contained that you may take the children from their parents and parents from their children and compel them to fight in the battles of any war in which the folly or the wickedness of our government may engage it? Under what concealment has this power lain hidden, which now for the first time comes forth? with a tremendous and baleful aspect to trample down and destroy the dearest rights of personal liberty. So, you know.
Well said.
You know, but they hit, basically what they said was, since every other government forces conscription on its citizens or subjects, the United States has that power too. Well, so much for American exceptionalism, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, how I look at like, you know, the history of the Supreme Court is basically it is part of the overall plan of the secret society. I think it's, you know, we've done a lot of detailing of the schematic, the present day schematic of how they're, you know, setting it up. And they have to use secrecy, have all these secret organizations, but they have to have also a secret control over the Supreme Court. So, you know, as with, like, say, Trump and Hillary, they create a dialectic. You get to have liberal Supreme Court justices are conservative, so-called, right? Seem to have issues that are, you know, they contest. But somehow, whenever the society decides to move culture into a place, which I think is actually, you know, trying to, I know this is kind of a hard concept to get, but I think that they basically are trying to adapt a legal structure that's compliant to their technology. So as they have created different kinds of technology, then they would need different kinds of legal structures in order to get the most out of it. And so they would need conscription when they had the automatic weapon, for example. They could, kill more people. And now you've got the police state. Well, the reason why these decisions, you know, are coming, you know, fast and furious is because, for one thing, you know, the issue is now at hand. You know, we've got the snooping is possible on a technological level. But you're going to see that even Catholics and people you would think would be libertarian will never be able to create a majority. There might be, you know, a 5-4 decision here and there. But, you know, the corporation has now become something that can fund political campaigns. There is just no control at all over NSA snooping, even though, in my opinion, it's an absolutely clear-cut violation of the Fourth Amendment, right? Because it snoops everybody. Mm-hmm. But somehow that just, none of these conservative Bush-appointed libertarian and political conservatives wanted to control government in any way in this area, right? And so I just think that as the technology is developed, the legal structure will be given to the population, and the Supreme Court will just be this, you know, it's a hand puppet of the secret society. And the people have learned, in the same way they have learned that the presidential election is, you know, something that indicates that they have some kind of democracy that they're participating in. The existence of the Supreme Court and of the different, you know, decisions it makes are, you know, it's just, again, it's just a hand puppet of the secret society. It's just there to create a little bit of drama and contestation over different things. But you're never going to see anything, in fact, this powerful that's going to stand up to the secret society. Just think about, okay, now you've had a lot of Catholics appointed, right? Well, why don't any of these Catholics try to reverse any of the decisions that led to a pornographic culture? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Where's that?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, when you look at FDR's connection to Wessler, right, and how they used the legal power to bludgeon all of the small sovereigns, you know, to basically prepare the way for Kinsey's debasement effort. You know, okay, well, maybe he had a Supreme Court that was Masonic, you know, you had different guys. But, well, what? Why now? Where is Catholicism and those kinds of principles being represented by the Supreme Court today? So there's just no place in the Supreme Court, as far as I can tell, for someone that isn't, you know, a lifetime actor.
Yeah, whenever you have a Catholic nominee, they're asked how – What do you do? You take your Catholic hat off and put on your civic hat when you become a justice. you know, to what extent does your Catholic dogma affect your jurisprudence? No one asks a Jewish nominee if, you know, does the Talmud affect your jurisprudence, right?
Well, that'd be an interesting talk.
you never hear that question
get asked. Into it, you know, so, well, let's go over some of these legal principles to see if, you know, that you are, in fact, influenced. But the fact is that the Catholicism of the of these justices, I think, is completely fake.
Which is why they can be a they can so easily be a Supreme Court justice because you couldn't otherwise, right? I mean,
exactly, yeah, and they certainly wouldn't be one that they would pick out. Remember, a lot of these guys were picked out by the Bush family.
Yes,
you know, Clarence Thomas and Roberts. I mean, I don't even know the names of these clowns. Right. But
Clarence Thomas, the Monsanto lawyer.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I mean, you know, they are either. You know, like with Thomas, I think here's someone who's just so reliably stupid and controllable that they, you know, he's a black face. And so this is, you know, that there's some political purpose for this. But then you've got.
That's right. He filled Thurgood Marshall's seat.
Yeah, that's right. The black face, you know. And Marshall, I think, was actually outed as a Mason. My memory serves. I'm pretty sure he was. Yeah.
Although I do think his final 15, 20 years, he was sleeping most of the time.
He was just as right, you know. But that's the thing is that people look to this. We really need, you know, with like the Supreme Court and the presidential elections and the Trump-Hillary dialectic, we just got to get people to stop
respecting them.
Fooled by this.
Well, I mean, not respected by the court because some of these issues are just ridiculous. Good example, you mentioned something in another case. Another case, you mentioned, you know, surveillance, and they were back in 2013, there was a 5-4 ruling that upheld the federal law that authorized the National Security Agency's eavesdropping ex post facto, actually. And this was the example of the high court's conservative bloc advancing the agenda of the secret society. It basically quashed any judicial inquiry into the constitutionality of the government's surveillance authority. There are some people, plaintiffs were saying that their rights are being violated because they were possibly being surveilled because of the broad nature of the surveillance program. And the court turned around, it's funny they called it the Catch-22 ruling, and said that these plaintiffs had no standing because they had no evidence that the secret program was surveilling them because it was because it was secret. It's obviously ridiculous. I mean, I don't have to go to law school to understand this is ridiculous. It's obviously a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's also a violation of free speech because there's a chilling effect here. But yet the court doesn't see it. And why? Of course they see it. They're not stupid. They're not allowed. They couldn't stop the NSA from doing this, you know, even if they wanted to, because they probably have the tapes of the parties these people go to.
Of course. And so that's just a great example of how fake this whole thing is. So, you know, what I would hope is that people stop being swept up in the drama. This is all just part of the control that they create to, you know, have people enslaved without their knowing it. And just stand back and look at these broad strokes. I mean, just ask yourself questions like, well, if there's so many Catholics on the bench, why is there so much pornography, you know, in the world? You know, the fact is that nothing that debases culture is ever overturned. Name one thing.
Yeah, because
name
they
one thing, yeah, right?
They knocked and, it all down. Yeah.
Okay, and then name one thing, one judicial decision that ever slowed down the creation of a technologic police state.
Mm-hmm.
Name one decision. So that just isn't circumstantial, in my opinion. It's impossible. If these guys were really honest, or were actually the political beings that they represented to the public. You would have from time to time, there would be some, you know, mustering of some Catholic perspective and they would slam down, you know, the pornographers. There would be some incarceration or, you know, some penalties that would take place. It never happens. There'd be some reversing or exposing of the NSA snooping, the violation of the Fourth Amendment. This never happens, ever. I mean, when Wechsler went around FDR got him to, you know, to go out and crush all of the the legal capacity of the small sovereigns, you know, the states, the counties, you know, et cetera, to resist pornography. You know, all of those, you know, the legal pressure that was put on these entities, that would have been lifted if there had been, you know, people who were legitimately Catholics or even Christians, for heaven's sakes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It never occurred, ever, and it never will. Because the what we think of as the Supreme Court is just a puppet show to make the illusion that there is this that there is some control of democracy into these entities that were set up you know by the Constitution. So you know the you know I mean to me it's sort of like the talking about the. You know, the good and bad of the Supreme Court is really just moving in the wrong direction. We should really just try to stay focused on, you know, who controls these people? You know, what clues are there about a hidden identity? You know, it's like, and that's why I think like the most important thing that's happened on the Supreme Court in the last 10 years to me was Scalia's death. Because it really showed people, wait a second, there's something in back of this. You know, there's some... that's not an organization an ordinary person would possibly belong to.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something mysterious about Scalia. Something needs to be investigated. And then if we go further, I think you're just going to find that all these people have these kinds of connections in one way or another. It's really hard, you know, to create a reliable enough lifetime puppet. You know, someone that you can just put on the Supreme Court and just know he's in the club. You know, without there being some traceable evidence. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Tough to build such a character. Scalia, I thought, was about as good as you can create, but he slipped up at the end. You know, he shouldn't have been messing around with, you know, this Masonic organization that has like the cross of Malta as its insignia. I mean, this, you know, if he was really a Catholic, just those things that alone would have been, you know, red flags to him, and he would have gone, well, you know, I really don't want to go out because this is clearly a, you know, this hunting facility is a, you know, it's just, let's face it, it's a Masonic cesspool, and I'm a Supreme Court justice, I don't want to let people think I'm being influenced by these guys, so I'm just going to stay away from it.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Nah, he goes there all the time. I mean, believe me, you trace into his life, you'll see stuff like this all over the place. And I think, this is what we should be doing, is that trying to alert the public that the decisions are all fake, they're all predetermined, the people we think are justices are just crypto, democracy is just this puppet show, and we really need to identify what is in back of these individuals and give that to the public. You know, it's like, I honestly think just arguing about the decisions, about the rationale, you know, like, I mean, to me, like the greatest puppet show was Bush Gore, you know?
Yeah, I remember that.
Like, this is really going to make a big, you know, a lot of difference which one gets in there, you know? it's preposterous, right? So we got to, you know, to make progress, we have to stop focusing on the puppet show that they give us. Look at the broad strokes, look at the whole theme of decisions of how they support the creation of the technological police state. Look at how supposedly, even though there's different ethnicities and different political perspective, there's never a reversing of anything, right? I mean, it doesn't matter who you have on there, you're never going to lose Roe because abortions are, you know, part of their genocide program.
Yeah, it was, that was... Griswold v. Connecticut, because that establishes the right to privacy, sure. which of course really facilitates the promotion, the government promotion of contraceptives and birth control.
Exactly.
And right. Roe v. Wade is another claim of right to privacy and 14th Amendment claims, but that's also there to promote abortion and infanticide.
Well, I mean, the thing is, just look at the, like the sophistry. I mean, okay.
The numbers of the emanations were there.
I mean, you got
another another Republican black or what's his name? Blackman, a Nixon appointee.
Okay, so it's like you got, when it comes to Roe, you have the right to privacy. But okay, but that's not a strong enough force to like stop the violation of the Fourth Amendment for snooping 100% of the internet.
Nor can you tell the IRS you have privacy.
Right. And so it's so wait a second, aren't you like selectively just picking, you know, things up? I mean, so that's what you got, is they will use, you know, whatever principles they need. There are so many there they can pick from to give some kind of a weak rationale to the public.
Well, like free speech for pornography to destroy a community.
Yeah.
To spread pornography to have its, you know, psychological warfare effect. So they wrap and shroud it in free, you know, the Bill of Rights, First Amendment, these things. And
yeah, but I mean, if someone wants to stand up and like, you know, heckle Hillary Clinton, that individual is tasered.
Yeah.
Well, what happened to free speech? I mean, so it's, you know, it's just, this is the thing. Try to look at the broad strokes. Don't get hung up on the individual, you know, issues and contradictions. That's a waste of time. That is the puppet show.
Oh, remember, was it Obamacare decision with Roberts?
Yeah.
Where he just he says, well, the Obama administration itself wasn't arguing that it was a tax. And he says, well, you better call it a tax. They call it a tax to, I guess, to make a justification for the Commerce Clause. But
yeah, because it could be tax then. And then, yeah.
But the Commerce Clause regulates commerce, doesn't mandate commerce, right? And of course, the idea of the Commerce Clause itself, it wasn't there to create a pretext for federal intrusion into the states. It was there to actually regulate trade among foreign nations, Indian tribes, and also to make sure that there were no internal tariffs. So that was pretty much it. I mean, that's, but that, you know, that goes back to Wicker v. Filburn, which the New Deal, when the government presumed the right to tell how much wheat a farmer could grow because it might have effect on the market. But these have long-standing effects. Same thing with Social Security, another, you know, New Deal legislation, which people was popular, like all boondoggle transfer schemes are, really, especially given the demographics. Only a few old people, a lot of young people, but then all of a sudden when they start imposing birth control and abortion, guess what? The demographics change. It's not supportable anymore. But and I think it was Helfering versus Davis, where they just said, well, it's general welfare. Yeah, general welfare.
That's right.
You know, it's like, well, no, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's, again, none of these cases where it's ups. Why would you establish a government of enumerated specific powers and then say, well, under general welfare, they can do whatever the heck they want, as long as they have a majority vote in the Congress and the president
signs. Yeah, I mean, that comes back to mind. I mean, this just shows that
the fix is in.
Yeah, the fix is in. And then there's some cover story that's just as ridiculous in this instance, you know, just ridiculous misapplication of a legal principle, or they just invent something, you know. I mean, but that's just how it is. It's a kangaroo court that's just there to enforce the process of the creation of a technologic slave state. And the hope is that the public will be able to look at these broad strokes and see a pattern, see how obvious it is, and then resist.
Well, that's what's discouraging, because you read about, you know, during the American Civil War, there were draft riots,
and yeah,
no one really complied, and even during World War One, there's a lot of resistance. There are hundreds of thousands of people just refused to go, but then I guess the psychological warfare kicks in, and over the course of so many wars, you sort of create sort of this bellicose collectivism, where by the time, you know, World War Two comes around, everyone just signs up and goes. Of course, then you have, you know, the setup of Pearl Harbor, so people aren't even thinking in those terms anymore. But by the 50s, you know, the people, the pretty much the generation that had, you know, that had fought, come of age during the good war, was just marched off loyally for the forgotten war, the Korean War.
Yeah.
And you didn't get any resistance until the Vietnam War, and that was more or less created. Actually, the system was designed to create the agitation of the Vietnam War, because that was part of the psychological warfare of that era, which is the war was only one component to it. The other component was
the
home front.
Sure, yeah, it was being fake, and that you can see that the so-called draft resistance was just part of the way they were creating this counterculture.
And goes to your point about regarding technology, because the whole atmosphere of the 60s required mass communication, popular music, television, these things, and you just mobility, the highway system and these things. If you have insulated communities, you just don't have the same effect. The moment you have mobility, the interstate highway system, mass communication, television, the movies, the collapse of the production code, the destruction of the urban neighborhoods, the development of the bland white middle class and these things, and all the court decisions, it goes like the Supreme Court, that's facilitating this, whether it's Berman v. Parker, or all the decisions regarding pornography. These things, they're all working towards that one end. And so it isn't less than the court sitting independent and looking at the law, and they've studied the Constitution, and they're maintaining the law, maintaining the Constitution. They're guardians of the rule of law. They're just part of the system. They're part of the game.
Exactly right. And so, it's time to start putting the Supreme Court in, particularly in the alt media. And I'm glad we're having this talk tonight, because it's funny, you'll hear guys in the alt media who know perfectly well that Trump and Clinton is a puppet show, but then they actually, for some reason, don't put the same scrutiny in the Supreme Court and then talk about decisions and, as like there was a real struggle taking place. There is no struggle taking place in the Supreme Court. The fix is absolutely in.
Do you think Ruth Bader Ginsburg is an objective jurist looking at the law? She was an activist. She was a feminist litigator.
Well, but even that, as she was represented, I think she was she's supposed to be the feminist, Eastern urban Jewish kind of sophisticate, and so it's just, I just see her as a lifetime actor. I don't know what's really in back of that person. She scares me just looking at her.
Well, this probably came into the fold during the Warren Court, but this is during the 1940s and 50s, particularly the 50s, but this notion that the court had was guided by what they call modern authority. And the court, judges became sociologists and legislators, and it was their duty to reform and improve American society that was stubbornly racist or backward. And of course, it wasn't necessarily true. There was a lot of progress being made. I don't think there was – no one required a court order for the Brooklyn Dodgers to bring in Jackie Robinson.
Yeah, but this was all just part of the destruction of the ethnic communities.
Yes.
And again, it's the litigation and legal principles that are needed for the current secret society maneuvers always seem to come into existence.
Yeah, like Brown versus Board of Education.
Yeah, there's a very strong relationship. And this is why, the schematic, the build out from, the present, going back in time, showing all the relationships between the political control that the secret society has had and how they're building their technologic slave state. Well, we can create the schematic of all of these activities, and then when you put the Supreme Court in it, you'll see that, wait a second, the fix is in. The decisions that are coming about are obviously artificially timed.
Yeah,
what they want to do.
Yeah, and they have an objective just beyond the mere decision that's being taken. Like Obamacare isn't about Obamacare is about technocracy. Okay, it's about getting one into the system. It's about mandating. It's about corporatist, fascist healthcare, getting one into the system. Ultimately, it's about technocracy. That's why it's there with the Electronic Medicals Act, or the Records Act, and these things. It's also there with Agenda 21 or Common Core. These things are all integrated. Good example is you mentioned Bush v. Gore in 2000 and the Supreme Court's role in that. And this is something you don't really hear about, but at the time, what happened? Of course, we all know what happened, supposedly, with the butterfly ballots and the hanging chads, and there's a dispute over Florida. Who would get Florida's electoral college votes? And so the litigation began between the two campaigns, Bush v. Gore. And of course, initially, the Secretary of State in Florida, who's a Republican, certified the votes. Then the Florida Supreme Court, which is really liberal, stepped in and started doing selective recounts. So then Bush sued in federal court, which is strange, in a certain district or something. I think Georgia, if I recall. The details are kind of fuzzy. But So all this litigation started, and this put Florida's Electoral College votes in jeopardy, because there's a deadline, mid-December, I believe, sometime, that they have to be certified and sent to Congress, so Congress can actually certify the votes, and that's when the president, the electors, elect the president, the Electoral College. One thing that people learned during that dispute was no one has a right to vote for president of the United States. It is the plenary authority of each state legislature to choose the manner in which electors are chosen. It just so happens they've all chosen a large to pick electors. They could theoretically, on a one day vote and say we're appointing all our electors, as they were, as many states did in the early 19th century and late 18th century. But nevertheless, what happened is this dispute between Bush v. Gore created all this litigation in the state courts and the federal courts. And you had the United States Supreme Court remanding the case a couple times back to the Supreme Court, telling them to redo the decision. You had a very activist Florida Supreme Court, very liberal activist Florida Supreme Court. Then the U.S. Supreme Court responding to that when the Bush campaign sued in federal court. Well, its final decision was very troubling. If I recall, it was an equal protection claim.
That's so bizarre. Yeah, I remember that.
And the thing about that is that because the deadline was approaching, the Florida legislature had a responsibility to make sure that their electors were counted. So what they had the power to turn around and appoint the electors in that particular presidential election. And those electors would go, because they have plenary authority, meaning there's no limit on their authority to choose the manner in which the electors are chosen. So given the fact that they were in dispute, the Florida legislature was heavily Republican at the time. And I think it still is, but at the time it's heavily Republican. So the solution, the constitutional solution, was for the Florida state legislature to appoint the electors, have Barbara Harris sign off on them, and send them off to Congress to vote. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court stepped in and cobbled together this majority and said, no, we have to stop the election. We have to stop these recounts because it's a violation of equal protection or something. And that defaulted to Bush's victory. My point is the Supreme Court did not have to step in and do this. The process would have worked out. But the problem is the process would have emphasized the power of the states in choosing the election. The presidential election is collectively a state matter.
Ah, I see your point.
Yeah, it's not a federal matter. There's no. Yeah, it's ultimately the states are choosing this. But the court stepped in, and this is one thing I try to make. I make these points when I'm at parties, when this comes up, and it just people don't understand it. So no. The Supreme Court did not have to step. Why did they do this? Because even if you're looking at politically, I'm talking among Republicans, that politically speaking, it would have gone to Bush anyway, because the Florida legislature, which actually is the most popular, at least the most representative body, would have chosen the Republican electors and elect George W. Bush as the 43rd president of the United States. So the question is, why does the Supreme Court feel compelled to step in and do this and hobble together this completely nonsensical decision to create controversy, to further federalize the presidential election system and marginalize the power and influence of the states?
I think you're right. I had never considered that. That may be why the whole pageant took place. Is that they just saw it as a moment where they could ratchet down the state's power even more and just sort of condition people into accepting federal judiciary control over state elections. So mm-hmm. You're right. That's a great broad stroke understanding of what you're dealing with it all ultimately ends up with dictatorship by a technologic slave state.
And the Constitution isn't perfect. It certainly hasn't prevented what's happened. And if it does allow for it, then it's no good anyway. But it hasn't, because it really is, at the end of the day, it's just a scrap of paper if people don't have the consciousness or the will to enforce it. And the point is ultimately what the Supreme Court was doing there was further marginalizing or just disregarding the constitutional process and just making it sort of putting their imprimatur on the stuff. It wasn't really legal or anything. It's just legal to the extent you had men in robes doing with judges and incense, maybe, or I don't know.
Right, yeah.
But there was no law to it. If you read it, it doesn't make any sense. The process, you had a process, an established process for the states to come in, for the state legislature to come in and choose those electors. And that's perfectly legal. It's perfectly legal.
And well, there it is. I mean, the states were, states' rights is something that, is one of the broad stroke concepts, and to see how states' rights have been systematically eroded, but only in the flow and in the logic, of the technology to establish the slave state and to take, advantages of opportunities to use state laws to give the illusion of democracy. I think it's all being very carefully monitored as they march us forward here.
Well, just like in the Civil War, how you had Masonic agitation on both sides.
Right? Yeah, in fact, I think one of the more important documents that people are, points of research to really understand the world that people can ever look at was that information you sent me a couple of weeks concerning the conclusion of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Where, Jefferson Davis was basically nothing but a skull and bones puppet. He was the president of the Confederacy, but his staff was nothing but these skull and bones individuals. And then he was captured by the Union, tried, but released by a judge who was a skull and bones member. I mean, here is the stench of a tiny secret society just controlling both sides of the political power of the Civil War, which was something in which the political class, no matter how you want to cut it, was able to maneuver the population into destroying one another.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And so if you look at the problem from that perspective and then see skull and bones on both sides of Davis's, capture and release and staffing, his efforts to basically control the Confederate armies as they marched into oblivion, you can see that, you really should be trying to understand the Supreme Court in that context. It's all context, and the context is the secret society control, and the context is genocide, and the context ultimately would be the Brave New World, where they have, state control of your mind. You won't even, there'll be no such thing as a free mind. I mean, all the minds will be manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if we want to resist, the time to do it is now. And the Supreme Court is pretty good, piece of the puzzle for people to be aware of and to use as how to explain, like we were talking about, what to bring to normies. Supreme Court is a pretty, and to show how obviously it is something that's controlled by oligarchs, for another term, is a really valuable thing. Something helps normies see the world in a clear way.
Yeah, and one thing, how it's controlled, as it was revealed through the NSA leaks that Samuel Alito.
Yeah.
He was, Bush appointee, Associate Justice. He was being wiretapped, and so was State Senator Barack Obama.
Sure.
And this is how these people. So it gives you an idea. All these people who are eventually selected for these positions, supposedly of power, are controlled.
And that's be too careful.
Yeah.
So, Jim, I would love to carry on this conversation. There's actually a few points I have written down here, but can't bring them up. I'm in a bit of a pickle tonight in that we're under evacuation watch. I live on the southern outskirts of Santa Barbara, and we are right in the line of what's called the Thomas Fire. And so we've just received some notification that we could get the dreaded, evacuation notice. It won't probably get down to my house, but they evacuate a large swath because these California fires, once they get rolled, there's no way to control it. So don't worry. Somehow I'll survive and maybe bring an interesting story to to tell next week.
Yes, okay, well, be safe. Do what you got to do. Hope for the best.
Okay,
be
thank
careful.
You so much.
And talk next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.